Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus said to his disciples, The coming of the Son of Man will repeat what happened in Noah's time. In the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and being married, right up to the day Noah entered the ark. They were totally unconcerned until the flood came and destroyed them. So will it be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be out in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal. One will be taken, and one will be left. Stay awake, therefore. You cannot know the day your Lord is coming. Be sure of this. If the owner of the house knew when the thief was coming, he would keep a watchful eye and not allow his house to be broken into. You must be prepared in the same way. The Son of Man is coming at the time you least expect.
In the first chapter of St. John's Gospel, Nathanael says to Jesus, You are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. And after commenting, You believe that just because I said I saw you under the fig tree, our Lord tells him he will see much greater things. Heaven laid open, and above, the Son of Man, the angels of God ascending and descending. This description of himself as the Son of Man is used by our Lord some 40 times, and the phrase occurs in the Gospels 80 times. After healing the man born blind, Jesus asks him if he believes in the Son of Man. Tell me who he is, so that I may believe in him, answers the man. And Jesus, you are looking at him. He is speaking to you. The phrase Son of Man, Barasha, is simply an idiomatic Hebrew way of saying man. And in the Old Testament, it appears many times with just that meaning. But in chapter 7 of the book of Daniel, we get, writes Frank Sheed, the mightiest and most mysterious use of the phrase. God is upon his throne, thousands upon thousands of angels ministering to him, and 10,000 times 100,000 standing before him. Then,
I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed.
This was the first of four prophetic visions Daniel received announcing the Messianic kingdom. The Son of Man, we read in a note, is the Messiah, to whom is given the eternal kingdom. This passage presents the figure of a Messiah coming with the clouds of heaven, and so of heavenly origin. And this, we're told, is the messianic aspect which Jesus ascribes to himself, habitually calling himself Son of Man and describing his coming as judge on the clouds of heaven. During our Lord's life, no one but he called him by this name. And after his death and resurrection, it disappears. He had been revealed as Messiah, so it was no longer needed. In today's Gospel, Jesus foretells his second coming at the end of the world and paints a dramatic picture. In the previous verses, he likens the coming of the Son of Man to lightning, which, flashing from one part of heaven, lights up the other. The sun is darkened, the moon does not give its light, the stars fall from heaven. And to help the disciples to imagine that day of judgment, our Lord says that it will be a repeat of what happened in Noah's day.
In the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And the waters prevailed so mightily upon the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep, and all flesh died that moved upon the earth, birds, cattle, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm upon the earth, and every man. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. Only Noah was left, and those that were with him in the ark, and the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days.
The flood, or the deluge, as it used to be called, has inspired artists throughout the ages. But although its message is serious, now and then a writer has seen the funny side of the event. Rudyard Kipling, in The Legend of Evil, has an Irishman telling the tale of Noah seeing the animals into the ark.
"'Twas when the rain fell steady and the ark was pitched and ready, that Noah got his orders for to take the beasts below. He dragged them all together by the horn and hide and feather, and all except the donkey was agreeable to go. Then Noah spoke him fairly, then talked to him severely, and then he cursed him squarely to the glory of the Lord. Devil take the ass that bred you, and the greater ass that fed you. Devil go with you, you spalpeen. And the donkey went aboard. But the wind was always failing, and 'twas most a noisy sailing, and the ladies in the cabin couldn't stand the stable air. And the beasts betwixt the hatches and took and died in batches, till Noah said, 'There's one of us that hasn't paid his fare.' For he heard a flusteration with the beasts of all creation, the trumpeting of elephants and bellowing of whales, and he saw for an inst the windy when he went to stop the shindy, the devil with a stable fork bedivelling their tails. The devil cursed outrageous, but Noah said umbrageous, 'To what am I indebted for this tenant right invasion?' And the devil gave for answer, 'Evict me if you can, sir, for I came in with the donkey on your honour's invitation.'"
When the waters of the flood had subsided and Noah and his family were back on dry land, Noah planted a vine. Now, although he was the first tiller of the soil, the Bible does not say that he was the first to cultivate the vine. But agriculture historians tell us that the vine comes from Armenia, and that is where the ark is supposed to have come to rest. The art of making wine goes back to prehistory in the Near East. But Noah was not used to wine. And while he was drunk, we read in Genesis, he uncovered himself inside his tent. His youngest son, Ham, found him there and went out to tell Shem and Japhet. But they had compassion on their father, caught, as the note explains, in the sleep of involuntary drunkenness, and showing more respect than their brother, took a cloak and, walking backwards, with their faces turned away, covered their father's nakedness. This episode has often been recounted in fanciful ways, and not always to Noah's credit. But the gentle humour of G.K. Chesterton cannot but bring a smile when he suggests that Noah was well acquainted with wine, even before the flood.
Old Noah, he had an ostrich farm and fowls on the largest scale. He ate his egg with a ladle in an egg cup big as a pail, and the soup he took was elephant soup, and the fish he took was whale. But they all were small to the cellar he took when he set out to sail. And Noah, he often said to his wife when he sat down to dine, "I don't care where the water goes if it doesn't get into the wine." The cataract of the cliff of heaven fell blinding off the brink, as if it were wash the stars away as suds go down a sink. The seven heavens came roaring down for the throats of hell to drink, and Noah, he cocked his eye and said, "It looks like rain, I think. The water has drowned the Matterhorn as deep as a Mendip mine. But I don't care where the water goes, if it doesn't get into the wine."
From that light-hearted diversion, we return to the solemn warning note sounded throughout this gospel. Stay awake. You cannot know the day your Lord is coming. The Son of Man is coming at the time you least expect. In his poem, The Second Coming, Yeats visualizes a horrific scene in which the disintegration of the world is accompanied by the arrival of the beast of the apocalypse.
Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. A vast image troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again.
Until it comes, no doubt people, poets or not, will continue to imagine how the world will end. But what's disconcerting in the words of Jesus to his disciples is that at the coming of the Son of Man, people will behave just as they did in the days before the flood, totally unconcerned, eating and drinking, marrying and being married, right up to the day. Whenever a great disaster strikes, people are carried away in the midst of their living. And for those who remain, it's always a warning. In John Donne's oft-quoted words, "Never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." Great natural disasters are traditionally described as acts of God. But there are other great disasters which can only be attributed to acts of man. When the first atomic bomb was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on the 6th of August 1945, the American President Harry Truman described it as the greatest thing in history. We read in an encyclopedia of historical facts.
In the immediate fireball and blast wave, between 75 and 100,000 people died. On the 9th of August, a second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. It killed more than 80,000 people. Within 5 years, nearly 500,000 people died of radiation effects from the two bombs. In 1959, Truman said, at Columbia University, that dropping the atom bomb was, quote, "no great decision. It was merely another powerful weapon in the arsenal of righteousness," unquote.
"Man's inhumanity to man makes countless thousands mourn," wrote the Scottish poet Robert Burns at the end of the 18th century. And in the name of righteousness, the inhumanity goes on. And the mourning. There are disasters and human tragedies which may not be intentional as such, but which are clearly the outcome of negligence, arrogance, and a total unconcern for the individual. High on this list is that of the Titanic. In an article about the loss of the Titanic, the writer called it a story about the hour of our death. Like the biblical flood, it's a story of death by water and of people carrying on with their lives unconcerned, even when they've had some warning, unwilling to accept the reality. As Walter Lord writes,
"The initial refusal to believe that anything serious is wrong, card games continuing in the smoking room, playful soccer matches on deck with chunks of ice broken from the berg, then the gradual dawning that there is real danger, and finally the realization that the end is at hand, with no apparent escape.
16-year-old Jack Thayer jumped from the sinking liner and, after swimming for his life, was eventually pulled onto one of the upturned lifeboats. From there, he watched the Titanic's last moments.
Her deck was turned slightly towards us. We could see groups of the people aboard, clinging in clusters or bunches like swarming bees, only to fall in masses, pairs or singly, as the great part of the ship, 250 feet of it, rose into the sky, till it reached a 65 or 70 degree angle. Here it seemed to pause and just hung for what felt like minutes. Gradually she turned her deck away from us, as though to hide from our sight the awful spectacle.
The boat Jack was clinging to was being sucked towards the ship, and the men on her were trying desperately to row her away.
I looked upwards. We were right under the three enormous propellers. For an instant, I thought they were sure to come right down on top of us. Then, with the deadened noise of the bursting of her last few gallant bulkheads, she slid quietly away from us, into the sea.
As the sea closed over the Titanic, there was a silence, followed almost immediately by the sound of hundreds of voices crying for help. Individual voices, writes Lord, were lost in a steady, overwhelming clamour. To Jack Thayer, lying on the keel of the lifeboat, the cries of the swimmers and others struggling for survival in the icy sea seemed like the high-pitched hum of locusts on a midsummer night in the woods back home in Pennsylvania. But long before dawn, the cries had ceased. Over 1,500 people died that April night of 1912, and yet still today people continue to wonder if only the Titanic had heeded the warnings. The end of the Titanic was not the end of the world, neither was the deluge, but the message in both events is unmistakable.
Thanks there to Jill Bivilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now we take a look once again at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Our resident Vatican expert Joan Lewis sat down with me to review some of the highlights of the past 7 days.
You know, it really was an incredible week, if you look back at what just the last 6 days. But I mean, the weekend, obviously, I think the whole world knows by now that the Catholic Church has 24 new cardinals, so the consistory to create them. Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, the wonderful courtesy visits in both the Paul VI Hall and rooms of the Apostolic Palace. Sunday morning, the Pope in Mass in St. Peter's Square gives the new cardinals their rings, and they all concelebrate Mass together. And it's a sea of red, really.
Absolutely.
Well, the cardinals were here last week for a day-long meeting with the Holy Father. So you had, I think it was 150 Saturday and 100 Sunday or something, cardinals all in their red finery, their
real
scarlet.
Real photo opportunity there.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And then behind them would be various shades of purple and fuchsia and so forth. And then you get to the black of priests and some monsignors. But anyway, very exciting days because the cardinals have huge groups that have come, friends, family, so forth.
Did you get to meet any of them, Joan?
Oh, quite a number, yes, on Saturday afternoon. And I obviously wanted to see the two Americans. I knew them very well because Cardinal Worrell of Washington and I have known each other for many years. He was in the Vatican 69 to 79 as the priest secretary of Cardinal John Wright, who headed the Congregation for the Clergy. And I was Cardinal Wright's from 75 to 79. I was the cardinal's private secretary on weekends.
Wow. So you knew him well.
We've known each other half half a lifetime. And
Cardinal Burke?
Met Cardinal Burke, obviously. Oh, yes. You know him as well. I knew him before this weekend, but a wonderful man, as orthodox as they come in the Catholic Church regarding the teaching of morals and so forth. An amazing man. And he looked radiant. He really looked radiant, as did so many of the others. But it's a huge moment, you know.
Absolutely.
We could have shaken the hand on Saturday with a future pope. You never know. So that's why I took a lot of pictures.
Good.
So I could say someday, oh, my gosh. Anytime there's a consistory, you always have that possibility. So wonderful events, wonderful words by the Holy Father to the new cardinals. And the only kind of, difficult point of the weekend was that Saturday afternoon, the Osservatore Romano comes out on the newsstands on a day with the next day's date. So Saturday it came out with the Sunday date of November 21st with a full page of excerpts from the book that was going to come out on Tuesday, a book-length interview by Peter Sewald, who spent 6 hours, 6 days, 1 hour each, this past summer with the Pope at Costa Gandolfo. And I think he asked something like 90 amazing questions. This is a book every single person who knows how to read and who is Christian or Catholic should have, if you want to know who this Pope is. It's an amazing, amazing book.
What is the book called?
Oh, The Light of the World. Thank you very much. Yes. Can't buy it if you don't know the title, you know.
Right.
And but anyway, the Osservatore came out with excerpts from different things. The Pope talks about sexuality, the Church and Islam, Jews, Pius the 12th, so many things, the Church on the world stage and so forth. And unfortunately, one of the items, a very touchy subject for so many people, happened to be about condoms. It was a question asked in the chapter in the book that has to do with papal travels. Peter Sewald asked the Pope about, now, you said this on the plane on the trip to Africa,
yes.
In 2009. What do you have to say about condoms? I am not phrasing the question as he did. I want to be very clear about that. Anyway, in the answer that the Pope gave, now again, we should tell our listeners, this is not church doctrine. It cannot change the teaching on condoms. It is banned by the church. The teaching on condoms cannot change by some remark the Pope makes. There would have to be a choral study of the matter and so forth. But the Pope seemed to indicate that when it was a question of possibly harming someone, giving them an illness, specifically AIDS, that in that instance it might be okay because the person would be trying to save the other person's life by not transmitting a disease. It's quite clear that obviously a condom can't be worn because sexual relations always have to be opened to life and so forth. So it's a huge explosive issue. The media took it and ran with it. It was the topic of all the conversations, obviously, at the receptions and dinners. And Sunday, Father Lombardi, papal spokesman, came out with a very lengthy explanation of what the Pope said. And I wrote on my blog, I said, in the first place, as I'm writing this blog, I do not know the two questions that Peter Sewald asked of the Pope, exactly how they were asked. I do not know the Pope's full response.
Right.
All I know is what the Osservatore Romano put. And you know, any of us know, you and I know, our listeners know, anything that is taken out of context, content change or taken out of context, of course a meaning is going to change about something. So I put the entire English translation from the book on my website so that people could see this context. So then the book was presented Tuesday.
The book was actually presented with great success.
Oh, my gosh. I walked in the press office and my impression was I had not seen the press office this crowded for any event since John Paul's obviously death and the election of Benedict and so forth. And other colleagues felt that same way. They had never seen that many televisions or anything. It was phenomenal, very well presented by Archbishop Rino Fisichella, who is, of course, heads the new Council for Evangelization, and by Luigi Accattoli, who Vaticanistes, we call people expert. Vatican affairs. And obviously the author was there and Father Lombardi was there. So what they did, Two very wonderful speeches were given by Cattolic journalist and by Archbishop Fisichella. And then Father Lombardi took all of the questions at once. People made notes. Right. So if they said, now, Archbishop, you know, and asked a question, the Archbishop would take notes. And then they answered all the questions at once. But they had to leave at noon, unfortunately. The conference began at 10:30. They had to leave at noon because the Holy Father was going to welcome them and the editors of the book in other languages. By Tuesday, they had had a 50,000 first run here in the Vatican, and I think it's today they're starting their second run.
Well, I've seen all the bookshops are lined.
Oh, yeah. The light of the world, folks. Go out and get it. It's out in Italian, English, and German right now. I really could not promote this book enough for the simple reason you get the most intimate, wonderful, profound, honest portrait of Pope Benedict.
Could you tell us what your favorite part was? What struck you most about it?
Well, I actually concentrated in the beginning, because I haven't read the whole thing. I've read bits and pieces. Just talking about his personal life, mm-hmm. his life in the Vatican, and oh my goodness,
so we have to. His personal life today.
His personal life today, right. And what his day-to-day life is like with the consecrated women who work for him. And I have to interject right here, one of the four consecrated women who worked for Holy Father, she was hit by a car on Tuesday night, and she died Wednesday morning. And I heard but did not see the papal audience on Wednesday, and I understand that the Holy Father, you could see his sadness and devastation on his face. But the Holy Father's life with the consecrated women and with his two priest secretaries. So the book was presented, as you said, with a great success. It's in all the stores around here now. It's harder to get the English. That's arriving, but they did give the journalists. You could get English, German, or Italian. So those are the two, the new cardinals and this book interview with the Pope, the two big events.
Did the author explain how he went about writing this book? You said he met the Pope every day for an hour.
He was given 6 days at the end. He went out to Castel Gandolfo and stayed in a hotel there.
He speaks Peter German, Sewald. If I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he is German. And so the Pope allowed him an hour a day for 6 days, so you can imagine. And 90 questions, that's an awful lot of questions to ask in a six-hour period. But some of the questions were just, he'd ask a question, the Pope would answer, and then Peter would say, why is that? So a brief follow-up question.
I saw on a news report that nothing was censored, that the Pope didn't have the questions in advance, so it was very much spontaneous.
Benedict is so brilliant. You would almost be insulting him if you gave him the questions in advance. You know, like, gee, I have to think about this. He's his own man. He knows what he knows, and he knows an awful lot. And you know what? The beauty of this book, this is a profoundly wonderful theologian, but he talks to us as if we're his friends. He talks to Peter Sewald, and therefore to us. The Pope probably wouldn't like it if you said it's about him, but it is. The Pope would tell you the book's about the Church. And they do talk about all the huge issues the Church is facing today around the world, from persecutions in Iraq. Thursday night there's a prayer service in St. Peter's Basilica for religious persecution, especially the people in Iraq. We know last weekend, actually, there was an illicit ordination in China.
That's right.
And there's the underground church and the loyal to Rome and the patriotic church allowed by the state. So there's these huge, huge problems. But the Pope, two things. He seems generally calm about most of this. You know, we shall overcome in a way. And he does seem optimistic and hopeful about the future. So that's wonderful. He does transmit that in all that he talks about. So light of the world, I think, is not only the Church. I think it's our Holy Father, to be honest with you. So it's been a big week this week. Let's see what happens next week.
We never know, do we? We never know. Bye-bye.
All right. God bless.
That's all from the English feature program today, but we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. So join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.